me this. When was the last time that you were really distraught? When was the last time that you were so concerned about something that it upset your soul? Right now I'm coaching Rocket basketball. Henry John, believe it or not, loves the game of basketball. I'm glad, because then I don't have to like force it. I don't have to force anything. He's always like, can we play, can we play, can we play? Received an email. Two coaches in the league, Henry John's playing at the fourth grade level. Two coaches in the league at the fifth grade level, I guess last Saturday, not yesterday, but a week ago, started yelling at each other, cursing at one another, yelling profanities at each other after the game, which turned into a physical altercation at center court in front of kids and parents in the stands. And I'm thinking, oh, wow. Right? That concerns my soul. As I'm reading this email, I'm thinking, what is going on? When was the last time you were really distraught? Maybe it was this week, watching CNN or MSNBC, watching things unfold in Japan, the effects of an earthquake, and then the resulting tsunami, a wave of water pushing its way through countryside, gobbling up anything in its path, buildings shaking. When was the last time you were really distraught? In the text we're going to look at for today, in Acts chapter 17, the story begins with Paul being very distraught. Who's got Acts chapter 17 in their Bible? I forgot to look up the page number. Shout it out. 785. Turn with me to Acts chapter 17. About halfway through, where it says, Paul in Athens. Story begins this way. It says, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed. He was greatly distressed. He was distraught. Paul's in Athens, Athens, Greece. And he's sitting there waiting. He's on a missionary journey in this story, and he's going from city to city, and he's preaching and teaching about Jesus Christ along the way, and he's starting new churches as he goes from city to city. Paul has just been in Berea, a city in the northern Greece. He was teaching and preaching there, but he had to leave Berea because some Jews there threatened Paul's life. They were creating a turmoil, agitating and stirring the crowd because of what Paul was doing. So, to protect Paul, some of the brothers who believed the truth of what Paul was preaching escorted and moved Paul to Athens under the cover of darkness. They moved him there, and he's sitting there, and he's waiting for Silas and Timothy to join him there. But while he's waiting for them, we read, in Athens, he was greatly distressed. Literally, his spirit was provoked within him. When's the last time you've had your spirit provoked? But why? Why was Paul's spirit provoked within him? Why was he so distressed? Read on with me in verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. The reason that Paul was so upset and distressed was because everywhere he looked in Athens, there were idols and idols and more idols. Athens was full of idols. Paul was distressed because the people of Athens had little or no understanding, little or no belief, little or no faith in the one true God. The God that Paul knew deep within his soul, the people of Athens did not. And as a result, the people of Athens were not receiving any of the benefits that come from faith in God. This distressed Paul's soul. So what did he do? What did he do on account of his distress? Did he just sit there in his belief, disbelief, shaking his head like, oh my word. Did he walk away in disgust? Man, I can't believe those people. Did he hope for the best for the people of Athens? Well, you know, a lot of idols there. Read on with me in verse 17. So he reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace, day by day, with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to debate with him. Some of them asked, what is this babbler trying to say? Others remarked, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him into a meeting of the Areopagus, where he said to them, may we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting. You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we would like to know what they mean. For you see, all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. I love that little phrase there. It's like daytime television right there. Right? Daytime television in action in Athens. How about that? What did Paul do as a result of what he saw in Athens? He walked right into the middle of it, is what he did. And he reasoned with the people of Athens. The Greek word for what Paul did is dialegomai. Right? An English word that we use comes from this Greek word, dialogue. Literally, Paul dialogued with them. Paul discussed. He conversed. And he reasoned with them. He talked with them. Where and with whom did he talk? First, in the synagogue, with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks. He went into the synagogues and the places of worship. He said, I know about Jesus. You know about Jesus. That he came and that he died for you. And that he was raised to new life. He wanted them to know that. And then from there, he went to the marketplace day by day, talking to those who happened to be there. He talked with some philosophers, some Epicureans, and some Stoics. And he debated with them. The marketplace, the agora in Greek, the cultural center of the city. It was the place of assembly in the city. Is the place where ideas were discussed, where commerce happened. I have a picture here of the marketplace ruins in Athens. There's not much happening there right now, is there? When I hear the word marketplace, I think of something like the Fulton Street Market here in the summertime. How many have been to the Fulton Street Market? Right. Got to get there early, because if you don't, got to be a little rude, don't you? You got to push and shove. Get what you want to get. Paul, he reasoned in the marketplace. And while he was there, he encountered these two different groups of philosophers. Some Epicureans and some Stoics. So I want to know, who remembers their intro to philosophy courses from high school and college? Uh-oh, shaking your heads there, Lauren. All right. Who remembers what the Epicureans believe? Who remembers what the Stoics believe? Some of you may be sitting here thinking, who cares, Pastor Henry? Who cares what the Epicureans believed? And who cares that Paul talked to them? I sure don't. I mean, they're all dead now anyway, aren't they? Why should I care about what they believe? If this is you this morning, let me say this. Knowing what these two groups believed is the key to understanding what Paul is going to say next. And if you and I don't know what they believed, then what Paul says later is going to make no sense at all. So let's start with the Epicureans. Epicureans valued pleasure. The absence of pain or disturbance. They disbelieved the gods of the ancient myths. They were deists. Do you know what deists are? Theists believed that God or a higher power created the world, but then left it. There's no more connection, no longer involved. God is uninvolved in the universe and it's irrelevant. God is distant, right? Hands off. Just let it go. Okay? Stoics. There weren't many Stoics in Greece, but their ideas were widely disseminated. They believed in a supreme God, but in a pantheistic way. How many of you know what a pantheist is? Anybody? Yeah, all right, there we go. Pantheism believes that nature and God are identical. Pantheists do not believe in a personal or a creator God. They deny the existence of a personal God. They deny the existence of a minded being that has intentions or capacities to make decisions. So for example, a natural pantheist will believe that nature, not a creator God, is the self-originating and eternal source of all being. So you want to know what God is? Just look around. Look around a minute. Right? God's everywhere. Right here in Cotter. You want to see God? It's in Cotter right here. Right? Presley, right here. God's right here. Right? Pastor Henry, look out the windows a minute. See those trees? God's there too. Right? You see any birds yet? God's there too. Right? God is everywhere. Flowers, they're coming. God will show up. Stars. God's there too. Because Stoics were pantheists, John Stott says, they saw the world as determined by fate. And because we are victims of fate, they advocated that human beings just resign to live in harmony with nature the best that they can, however painful it might be. Develop your own self-sufficiency. Do the best you can with what you have. Because we're just victims of how it's working. So tell me this, do you know any Epicureans? Do you know anyone who values pleasure and tries to avoid pain at all cost? Do you know anyone like that? Do you know anyone who believes that God cares little or nothing about them and what's going on in their life? Do you know any Stoics? Do you know anyone who denies that there is such thing as a personal creator God? Do you know any pantheists? People who believe that there's a little bit of God everywhere. Do you know people who believe that we're just victims of fate? We just got to make do one day at a time? I know people like this. I know people who believe these things. It was an account of beliefs like this that Paul's soul was greatly distressed. It was on account of these beliefs that Paul reasoned with the people of Athens to try and make known to them something they did not yet know. And it was on account of what Paul reasoned with them that he was invited to speak at the Areopagus, the Rock of Ares. The place in classical times that functioned as the court of appeals for seminal and criminal cases. This is where the Supreme Court would gather. They'd stand up on this rock, the Areopagus. Right? It's kind of like what we would call our Supreme Court today. The judicial council, the elders would meet there. And it's where truth was determined. The truth about cases was decided and determined here. So they invited Paul, come, share with us this new teaching. So what did Paul say when he was standing there? What did he say to the people of Athens about God? What did he say to the people for whom his soul was distressed? Look with me at verse 22. He says this. He says, people of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship, and this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by human hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man he made all nations that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he marked out their appointed times and histories and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image by human design and skill. In the past, God has overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. So what does Paul proclaim about God as he reasoned here? Two main things. First, he says that God is the creator of heaven and earth. God created everything they see. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth. And he doesn't live in temples built by these. And he's not served by these. God is not a man-made thing. God is the maker of man. God is not the same as creation as the Stoics believed. God is distinct and separate from it. The Athenians were worshiping created things. Things made with these. Paul says, no. Worship the Creator, not the created. But then he says this, the second thing. In addition to God being the Creator, God is also the sustainer of everything that he has made. In verse 28, Paul quotes a Cretan philosopher, someone whom the Athenians would be familiar with, when he says, in him, that is God, we live and we move and we have our being. He himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. He determines the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. What Paul's trying to say to them is he's not so separate, he's not so distant, he's not so removed from his creations like those Epicureans believed. No, God is at work in their midst. He is involved with their creation. He is involved in your heart and life. God is sustaining his creation. And Christians have a name for this. It's called providence. And what is providence? Providence is the almighty and ever-present power of God by which he upholds as with his hand heaven and earth and all creatures, and so rules them that leaf and blade, rain and drought, fruitful and lean years, food and drink, health and sickness, prosperity and poverty, all things, in fact, come to us not by chance or fate, but from his fatherly hand. Do you see the ends of the spectrum there? Rain and drought. Fruitful and lean. Food and drink. Health and sickness. All those things come to us from God's hand. Kevin DeYoung, in his comments about God's providence, reminds you and me that in addition to affirming our human responsibility for our own actions, the Bible also affirms much more massively and frequently than some may imagine, God's power and His authority over all things. The Scriptures teach us that God has the power and authority over nations, over nature, over animals, over Satan and evil spirits, over wicked people. God has the power to harden and soften our hearts, to send trouble and calamity, even to put to death. And DeYoung goes on to say that we can look at God's providence in different ways. We can look at it through different lenses. He says you can look at providence through the lens of human autonomy, right? And idolatrous notions of freedom, and see a mean God moving tsunamis and kings like chess pieces in some kind of diverse divine game. We can look at God that way, that there's this God up there, He's kind of doing things willy-nilly, and it's against us. Or you can look at providence, He says, through the lens of Scripture, and see a loving God counting hairs on our head, right? And directing sparrows that fly through the sky so that we might live unafraid. God with us. Two ways of looking at it. God against us or God with us. This is what Paul wanted the Athenians to see and believe. This is what the writers of the Catechism want us to see today. For if we choose that latter option, the belief that in providence God is for us, that He is with us, that He is not against us, the Catechism reminds us that providence helps us in three very specific ways. Because of providence, we can be patient when things go against us. We can be thankful when things go well. And for the future, we can have good confidence in our faithful God and Father that nothing will separate us from His love. All creatures are so completely in His hand that without His will, they can neither move nor be moved. Friends, tell me this. Have you ever had things go against you? Am I the only one? No, you chuckle. That's right. Thank you. Jeremiah and I, partner with things going against us. Thank you. Honest man. We've all had things go against us. When they do, providence helps us. How? It gives us patience in the midst of the pandemonium. It gives us patience. Week and a half ago, some good friends of ours, their daughter was in the hospital. So Amy and I, we spent a lot of our time in that place. Very nice building, I might add. However, being inside that hospital was a little tense. Their daughter had this bizarre infection in her ear, which if you Wikipedia the name of the disease, was the leading cause of death in children before they figured out what it was and how to treat it. So there you sit on the sixth floor of the Helena Bosch Children's Hospital. What does providence do for you when you're sitting there looking at your daughter or looking at your friend's daughter hooked up to IVs, doctors coming in and out trying to figure out what in the world it is? Providence enables us to sit in the room differently. Why? Because providence affirms that God is in control. So when things are going crazy, we can be patient. When things are going crazy, we can be patient. We all have times in our lives where things are going crazy. If we don't believe that we have a God that's for us, that's a tough spot to be in, isn't it? It's a tough spot. But the Scriptures remind us that He is not far from us. We aren't deists. Christianity affirms that God is with us, that He is involved. So we can have patience. What do the people of Japan need right now? What do we all need? They need something that they can stand on. We all need something that we can stand on, something that's firm, something that's solid. They were standing, what happened to the ground they were standing on? It was moving all around. The buildings they were in were shaking. The created, right? The things that they had created were swept away. Paul says, don't depend on those. Don't depend on the things that we make with our own hands. Right? Depend on something greater. The Creator. Right? We all need that. We all need that. But then there's those times in our lives where things go well. Right? We're not always in the pandemonium, are we? Some of us remember the 90s, right? Things were going up. They were. Everything was going up. Life was good. Money was easy. We were financing. We were buying. It was woo. We were making. We were creating. Were we? Interest rates were was great. Right? When we strike it rich, what does providence do for us? It reminds us that these didn't do it. Right? These did not do it. What did? Who did? The Lord. Right? God. So when things are going swell, right? What does Paul say? Thank you. Thank you for what you are doing in my midst. Right? When we look around and we see our family and things are good, Lord, thank you. Thank you for what you're doing. Providence allows us to give credit where credit's due. Right? Providence allows us to get over our ego and think we're all that and then some. Look at me, la da da. Right? It's not what these have done, but it's what He has done. So when things are going well, Providence says, Lord, thank you. I know that you are involved in my life. I know what you are doing. I give you praise. I give you honor. I give you glory for it. Thank you, thank you. If we don't have that type of God, where's the praise going to go? Right here. Right? Look at me, look at me. Providence allows us to be thankful. But what about the future? Right? What about the future? The great unknown. Monday's coming. How's it going to go? Do we want to get up or not? What does providence do for our future? It gives us confidence. Right? If we believe that Paul is telling the truth in Romans chapter 5 and chapter 8 when he says that nothing can separate us from the love of God, then you and I can be confident for whatever's coming. But do we believe what he's saying is true? Do we believe that nothing can separate us from the love of God? And I mean nothing. Right? If we do, we don't have to worry. If God is in control, we don't have to worry about our kids growing up and going off to college and moving out, do we? If God is in control, I mean, grandma's got to go into the nursing home.
we don't have to worry, do we? If we have to make a job change, and God is in control, and He's with me, and He's not against me, I don't have to worry, do I? If we're thinking about starting a new church, and God is in control, does that change something about how we approach that new church start? So we look forward to our own death. Right? Do we have to worry or not? People of God, Paul was so concerned that the people of Athens know that God is both their creator and their sustainer. Why? Why did he want to know about providence? Why did he want to know about the involvement of God? Why does he want you and me to know about it here this morning? Because knowing that, knowing who God is, that He is my creator, and that He is my sustainer, changes who I am. It changes who we are. It changes who I am on the inside and how I live on the outside. Providence doesn't teach us that everything is going to be fine and that everything is going to go our way. So please don't hear that, because tomorrow may be bad. But what Providence does teach us is even if tomorrow is bad, God is still for you. That God loves you and that nothing, not even bad Monday, can separate you from that love. Nothing. Providence allows me to rest in that security, in who He is and what He has done. And the proof that Paul gives, he says, you want proof? He says, look at Jesus. You want to know that God is for you and not against you? You want a proof that God cares for you? He says, look at Jesus, His death and resurrection, and then get back to me. And if God dying for you, or His Son giving His life for you, doesn't prove that He is with you and for you, I don't know what will. So I am this morning, I ask you, do you need anything from the providence of God this morning? Where are you at this morning? Do you need patience? Is life a mess right now? Is it a pandemonium? Is it crazy? Do you need patience? Or do you need thankfulness this morning? Are things going well? Is your ego a little higher than it should? Are you putting too much trust in these? And not enough trust in His? Are you worrying about tomorrow? Are you worrying about next year? Are you just worrying? Do you need confidence this morning? I invite you to turn to Him. Turn to Him. Would you pray with me?